session number 17896, row 6.
Did you have good intelligence sources out there? I mean, could you spot trouble coming easily?
Yes, at that time. We had the B specials then, which Harold Wilson disbanded in 1968 or 9 when the trouble started. But most of the B specials were ex-servicemen. And they operated from villages all around the north of Ireland. And in those villages, they knew everyone. And therefore, any stranger coming in was known. And when we had the B specials, and we had a good special branch at that time in Northern Ireland, and there wasn't the same awful nationalist, you know, anti-British feeling at all that there is now. I mean, that's been fanned by weak British politicians here who've asked the south of Ireland to come in on things, which is, to my mind, a great mistake.
And people forget that, in fact, British forces went over to Ireland originally, to Ulster, yeah, to protect the Catholic community.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
And I remember seeing pictures on television of people, Catholic women, bringing cups of tea to the squaddies.
Yes, outside that's
their
right.
Houses.
That's right.
And that was obviously exploited by the IRA.
That's the awful thing, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's I know I'm Irish myself, but I say they are such wonderful people. And, you know, there's never been any religion in my regiment. I mean, when I say there's always been religion, but there's never been any sectarianism in an Irish regiment. And I used to go up the Falls Road in uniform to see my soldiers, even in, but that was 1958, when I was commanding my depot. When I came back from Cyprus, I went up. I had a sergeant up there who wasn't well. I wanted to see him. He lived in the Falls Road. I went up to see him there in uniform, battle dress.
Because the troubles didn't, or the current batch of troubles didn't start till about 68, did it?
That's quite right. We were home on leave from Oman when it started. Yeah. It was terribly badly handled.
Mm. Now, you were talking about being at your depot with searchlights on the gates.
Yes.
And guns. This was when? After the civil rights marches? When it
no, started? This was 58.
58, yeah.
58 to 60 when I was there.
Really? Mm. As serious as that then?
Well, we had a... Yes, but it wasn't considered serious enough to reinforce Northern Ireland at all. And it wasn't serious enough. They were quite right. I mean, we had, I think, two resident battalions, one up in Derry and one down at Ballykinler, or Hollywood, one at Hollywood, and maybe one at Ballykinler. Yes, there was a brigade, 39 Brigade, three battalions there of regular soldiers, but they weren't involved at all. And then the three Irish regiment depots.
So there weren't, were there the sort of marches and things that went on the
Orient. Oh, well, they always march on, yeah, always. On the 12th of July, and there's some date in August that the sort of real tough, keen Roman Catholics used to march. I think they used to call them the Black Men, but I can't remember. But people treated it more as a sort of a joke, really. You know, there was never any... I mean, they put their bands out, made a hell of a noise, and they worked themselves up for a day, but I don't remember any trouble ever there at that time, until, as you rightly say, 1968 when it started.
Did you go back after 68?
I went back every year because my mother was living with my married sister in County Donegal. Mm. And I love Ireland, and I went back because I wanted to go back there.
But you went back as a soldier? As
a oh, yes, yeah. Yeah.
And how has the situation changed compared to the... 58,
60. Oh, God, completely. I mean, there was this atmosphere of hatred which hadn't been there before. And I felt this atmosphere of absolute ineptness on the part of the British politicians. Because instead of firmly handling the trouble when it broke out, they stood back and did nothing, and they allowed there to be no-go areas. I didn't think that the people at the top in any of the positions were strong at all. And, of course, it was interesting that the Home Secretary's wife was a Roman Catholic. And therefore, I feel that Callaghan felt that his... I often wonder if his wife influenced him. You know, don't be too hard on these people and so on. And, of course, it then all built up instead of being put down immediately, which it could have been.
Of course, there was a certain amount of justification.
Tremendous amount.
In civil rights.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I quite agree. Yes, I quite agree. All that had to be put right. Mm. I quite agree. But you cannot let anarchism take over, which is what happened. And if it had been handled, you know, if it had been handled... Terence O'Neill, you see, was too much the other way for... Terence O'Neill, when he became Prime Minister, he was too soft and misunderstood by the Unionists, who considered he was too soft. And I think that the Roman Catholics didn't respect him. It did need a very special man there. I don't know who it would have been, or woman. The whole thing has been mishandled since 1968, and I frankly blame Harold Wilson and his government for the situation as it is now. When old Sir Basil Brooke was alive, although it was simply frightful, the bias against, the bigotry against Catholics, at least the country was utterly stable. No trouble, no problems at all. But then when he went, we got a succession of lesser men, and then, of course, we got Harold Wilson. And
of course, the... Tinder, if you like, that's probably started all this trouble, was the unemployment.
Yes.
Lack of jobs.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, you've got plenty of sectarian divides in this country.
Yes.
But they're usually in prosperous communities.
Yes.
And they haven't got anything to fight each other over.
Yes.
I think you look at the Tutsis and the whatevers in yes. Burundi.
Yeah.
I mean, they're at each other's throats because there's not enough land.
Yes.
One tribe is getting all the best, the same in Bosnia.
Yes.
If everyone had a full belly at the end of the day,
yes.
No one cares if they're Muslims or Croats or
no.
Whatever. And I think that's a lot of the problem in Ireland. I mean, the unemployment's happening, factories have been shut down there. The shipyard, Harland and Wolf.
Yes, terrible, yes.
Well, what it was.
Yes, absolutely. And you couldn't get a job in Harland and Wolf unless you were a Protestant.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit now of your time in Germany?
Yes, I went out as second in command for a year, and we did all the usual things they do in Rhine Army, and as you do in an infantry battalion. I mean, you go through the...
You were battalion commander?
No, I was second in command my first year, yes, for my first year. And as second in command, I obviously deputized for my colonel whenever he was away, and he gave me various things to run. And one of the things I ran was the training, and that again was the usual army training, starting off at section level until you took the battalion out on battalion exercises and brigade and division corps and Rhine Army exercises. And we did train hard there, but also there was a lot to do. And I know when I became commanding officer, because I was very keen on sport, I found that if I swore when I got command of the Ulster Rifles that I would keep my Irish soldiers more tired than I was, because Irishmen only get into trouble when they're not tired. That's a bit of an extremist thing to say, but I know bloody well, my chaps, that you've got to keep them interested, and you've got to be very efficient. I mean, they want to be professional. But you must look after their spare time. And in those days, officers' wives did much more in helping with the family side than they do now. Most of the officers' wives nowadays have got careers of their own. And so, you know, they're not there to help the colonel's wife with the welfare side. We were a very, very close battalion. And I used to make... unless there was an exercise, I'd make Wednesday afternoon a games afternoon where every single person in the battalion had to do something physical. And then on Saturday morning, I normally inspected some part of the barracks. Now, if I wasn't pleased with that inspection, those people responsible were going to have a pretty busy weekend. So what that meant was that on Friday, people didn't go out because they were all... getting their own part of the barracks ready in case I should visit it. Once I'd done my inspection, we probably had a drill parade, and either the regimental sergeant major took it or the adjutant, or the second in command, or me. And I always had the band, bugles and pipes. In those days, we had our own regimental bands, because drill to music is very enjoyable, especially if it's being done well. And then when that was over, from 11 o'clock onwards, again, I made everyone play games. So everyone had to appear in a tracksuit. And then, if it was rugger or soccer, they would change into their strips for it. And then on Saturday afternoon, I used to have coaches for them. They'd all go to Winterberg. And in the winter in Winterberg, they'd ski and toboggan and skate and so on. In the summer, they'd swim or fish or sail. And on Sunday, I encouraged them all to go to church. And my Roman Catholic padre was tremendous, making bloody sure that his flock went to church. And then when we'd done that again, we hoped they would enjoy themselves, doing whatever they wanted to do. So, in fact, Germany was a great place to soldier in. The very good training areas. We got to know...
A well-recognized threat.
A really well-recognized threat. And we cooperated very closely with the Bundeswehr. And I had two friends who were commanding a tank regiment called Karl Matz. And he had only got one arm. He'd lost it fighting the Russians. And Karl Bless, who had actually fought the Americans and ourselves. But they all became very good friends. We all became good friends. And the German people in Iserlohn were very kind to us. And we got on awfully well. We always had them up to retreat parades and all that sort of thing. And it was a jolly happy station. And occasionally, on manoeuvres, one day I took my battalion and I had 96 armoured personnel carriers and I motored to Schleswig-Holstein. And we took part in an exercise there with all our backup, our lorries and everything else. We saw a part of the country we'd never seen before, so interesting. And then we attended an initiation ceremony of a German panzer division, that sort of thing. And you could send your boys away, say at Easter, give them something to do, send them away and give them a competition, like saying, right, we'll give a prize to the chap who gets furthest away from Iserlohn, and you've got to send us a postcard from wherever you get. And we get. I got one postcard, as I mentioned in my book, from the United States, because some of my chaps went down to Frankfurt, persuaded the United States Air Force to let them on an aircraft that was flying over to somewhere in the States, and then we got a postcard from Seattle eventually or somewhere, and they came back, and people went to, to Holland and France and so on. An awful lot of people camped in their holidays there, and it was a very happy station.
I can see, it sounds probably a platitude, but you have to work damn hard to keep a disciplined force together. One looks at the well-publicised incidents in Cyprus recently. Mm-hmm. And, I remember when I was living in Guildford, every Saturday night there used to be a drunken punch-up in the town. Squaddies over from Aldershot being, military police over and everything. Where people get bored.
Yes. I would sack the colonel immediately, and I did I have sacked colonels before.
Have you?
Yeah. The thing is that you take all the praise and plaudits. If your battalion does well, the colonel must take the raspberries as well. And as the old Chinese proverb, the head of the fish stinks first. And if there's anything wrong, that unit out in Cyprus where they killed that poor Danish girl, raped her and killed her, that colonel, if I'd been out there, would have been on the first aircraft back, out, and they could court-martial him at home. I wouldn't have kept him there. And I think that...
What has happened to him? Did
he come back? He got promoted.
Really? Yeah.
He got promoted purely because his name had already gone up for promotion and it had come through. I think he's out of the army now. But, that there's no excuse for bad behaviour. There's no excuse.
The cases one also reads about bullying.
Well, I never had bullying. I'm
bullied for weeks.
Yeah, I'm amazed.
Why hasn't someone heard about it further on?
Exactly. A bloody bad battalion. NCO's bad.
Yeah.
Platoon officer's bad. Company commander bad. Commanding officer, above all. You must know what's going on in your battalion. You must know. And that comes having a really good sergeant's mess, good regimental sergeant major, good sergeant's mess. You must know everything. I knew every single man in my battalion by name. Every one. because I was lucky, I'd commanded the depot. I'd probably recruited half of them, trained them from the moment they came in, then been there second in command and, you know, got to know more people in the battalion. And by the time I was CO, I knew every single man. And I reckon every colonel has, no colonel has any excuse not to know every single one of his men. And if they've got a family, to know his wife as well. It may sound a tall order, but it isn't. I've done it.
Because the trouble now also is that you've got a much more relaxed social code anyway in Civvy Street.
Yes.
More permissive.
And yes.
And that sapping influence filters into the army.
Yes.
Into the armed forces. They're much more relaxed.
Yes.
And they're less likely to fall in line, and therefore man management becomes much more skilled.
Yes.
And much more precise.
Yes.
You'd agree with that point, presumably.
Yes, I don't
think... It's more commanding troops these days than it would have been 20 years ago, do you think?
I honestly, I don't think so, because I don't think their standards now are as high as the standards that I was used to, quite frankly. And I do keep in touch with what's going on, because I was honorary colonel of a couple of different things until very recently. And, I, of course, I know through my son in the army what's going on. I don't think... I find them now bloody good, actually. I really do. I don't think it's really changed all that amount. The only thing that has changed since my day is drugs. And again, I don't know enough about that. I know when my son, Tim, discovered he had a drug case over in Northern Ireland, he immediately acted and had that chap court-martialed. Immediately. I mean, I know for a fact that another regiment out there had got drug cases, and they never reported it. Because, of course, it would give them a bad name, you know, and wouldn't reflect well on the colonel that he'd got drug people. And Timothy, I thank God, was dead honest about it.
And you had a happy time there.
Yes.
There was no panics or anything, was there? I mean, did you get any sort of...
Yes, there was one time. There was one time when they thought the Russians were going to move. I can't remember. My general was a French-Canadian chap called Jean-Victor Allard, and I know he had us. We were all called in and told to be in complete readiness. Because I remember I had a guest night that night, and I wondered if I'd be at war next morning. And I had this Karl Matz with his one arm, was one of my guests at the guest night. And, of course, the Bundeswehr had been briefed as well. And old Karl got pissed and said to me, come on, Corin, he said, you and I, let's get in our armoured vehicles and go and meet the Russians now. You know, it had to sort of calm him down. But we had just had the one time when it really did sound dicey. I can't remember which year it was even. Must have been 1963, I suppose. Maybe late 62.
Were you trained for nuclear and biological warfare?
Yes.
You had your suit, your noddy
suits? No, we didn't have noddy suits, no. No.
Did you know the disposition of the forces opposite you? Did you know which units they were? Likely to meet?
No, I frankly didn't know. I don't think anyone in our brigade knew that. Apart from the... Never got down from our brigadier to us, commanding officers, no.
And you weren't... I mean, there were tactical nuclear weapons in the armouries, presumably.
I suppose there were. We never discussed them.
I suppose the Royal Artillery would have had those on.
Yes, them. Yes. They had. We had missile...
Lance missiles.
We had missile regiments there. There was one quite near us. But that's right. But
so
I can't... Yes, I suppose they were nuclear. And the awful thing is that I don't really remember a great deal about that side of things. I think quite honestly that none of us, apart from that one little blip we had, for one moment thought it would come to war.
Yeah.
Maybe wishful thinking, but we felt that way.
Now, I've recorded a number of second TAF pilots at that time, and I think they were quite rather more... I mean, they admit to flying with nuclear weapons.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
And they did...
My God.
Labs manoeuvres, too.
Really?
You know, where they pull up, let it go.
Yes. God, yeah.
With dummies, obviously.
Gosh.
Over the North Sea.
My hat.
So, I mean, they were more prized. And lots of other things, reconnaissance.
Yes.
Overflying.
Yes.
Canberra pilots were flying over Russia at one time.
Were they? God.
60,000 feet, they couldn't catch them.
Good Lord. How amazing.
Anyway, that was your time in Germany.
Or yes.
Have I forgotten something?
No, not at all, no.
I'm conscious that I want to cover Borneo and
Yes.
Stay with me.
Yes, sure, yeah, of course.
You went briefly to Australia, I believe.
Yes, I did, actually.
What was the object of that exercise?
Well, it was to prove, I think the Aussies felt, you know, the Brits had forgotten them. And they wanted to prove to the Australians that if they needed us, we could send a battalion out in a matter of a couple of days. And my battalion was selected to be the one from the Strategic Reserve that went out there. And we went out in 7 Britannias, which were, do you remember them? They were turboprops. And we staged at El Adam and Gann, and then we got to RAAF Williamburg, and then we deplaned there, and then we went to a place called Singleton, which was our sort of camp before the exercise started. But that was the reason, to show that we could send at least a battalion out very quickly to Australia if necessary. We then did a fortnight's acclimatization, which I set some battalion exercises, because it was very, very hot. Even it was December, actually. November. I'd already been out and done a reconnaissance accompanied by my second in command. And then we then took part in a fortnight's exercise with the Australian Army. They had a thing at that time called the Pentropic Division, which was training for operations in Southeast Asia, be it Malaya, Vietnam, wherever. And we did an exercise in that sort of jungle setting, which was a very rugged, but strange to say, my battalion said not nearly as tough as the exercises I set for them, so that we were well equipped when we went into it. And we did, people seem to think we did very well. At the back of my book, there's a very nice letter from the Queen, actually, which we were all very proud to get. And it was while we were out there that we were told, oh, and then we had a fortnight sort of showing the flag when we did retreat parades. I'd rather a good band, bugles and pipes, you know. They really were rather good. And the Aussies loved them. We mounted guard in Sydney and did that sort of thing, did big retreat parades, fraternized with the Returned Servicemen's League. We had an affiliated regiment out there, the Adelaide University Regiment, and that sort of thing. And then we flew home, and as I got into the aircraft to fly home, I got a little signal saying you've been selected to go to Borneo, and your advance party goes on the 5th of January. And this was given to me on the 18th of December. So I couldn't go on leave at all, and nor could my adjutant or my adjutant, my orderly room quartermaster sergeant, and my quartermaster. And I let everyone else go on leave. And then we got the advance party off on the 5th of January. And then we flew out to Hong Kong. And then we started going through the jungle warfare school at Kota Tinggi in Malaya. And then...
did you have new lessons to learn there?
No. They were the same lessons that applied to the Malayan emergency, operating in the jungle, just the same. Terribly basic.
Now, the scenario there was that Indonesia wanted to occupy the rest of it. It owned most of Borneo anyway.
That's right.
You had,
they called it Kalimantan.
Yes. But then you had Sarawak and...
Sabah, Brunei and Sarawak, yes.
Part of Malaysia.
Yes.
And was it Sukarno?
Yes, it was Sukarno, and that's what upset him, because his idea was apparently that he wanted a thing called Mafilindo with himself as the boss man eventually, which was Malaysia and the Philippines and Indonesia as one sort of superpower. And, of course, Philippines, nothing happened about that as far as he was concerned. But by us having given Malaysia and Malaya independence, then allowing it to have Brunei, Sarawak, and Sabah. In fact, we really rather ragooned them into going there. I don't think they wanted to leave us. Of course, he was furious. And so the first thing was one got the Brunei revolt. Then we got trouble in Sabah and Sarawak. And he had irregulars there, first of all. And then he ended up using his regular battalions, who were very brave and very well trained. And we had some good scraps with them.
Now, this again was all jungle warfare.
Yes.
Presumably, your intelligence knew the trails and where they were.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes, in the 3rd Division, certainly, yes. my second 6 months in the 1st Division was where everything happened, and it wasn't nearly so jungly, although there was jungle. There was lots of jungle, but there were also lots of open terrain there as well. And they had some quite big mountains. Well, they got mountains all the way down. But
where was the 1st Division geographically?
Well, you know Kuching?
Yes.
Well, from Kuching inland to Sirian. That was the 1st Division. And then from Sirian, Semangang, I can't remember where the 2nd Division ended because I wasn't in it. And then the main town in the 3rd Division was Cebu. That was the capital of it, really, provincial capital, divisional capital.
And what was their mode of operation? I mean, were they trying to inject whole armies of regulars in, or were they just sort of infiltrations?
They did infiltrate. They would send groups in to attack an isolated, or what they hoped was an isolated position. They'd go into the kampongs in Sarawak, certainly. They'd go into the kampong and swagger about, you know, and say, this is our country, and rather terrorize the people. And you couldn't have soldiers in every kampong. So what we had pretty good intelligence, I think. Anyway, we knew, you're quite right, we knew the main crossing places, although it was more difficult in the 1st Division because it was more open. But you pretty well knew where they were coming. And then the idea was that once you knew where they'd crossed the border, you put an ambush in behind them where they'd crossed it to wait for them when they were coming out. Then you would move other soldiers to meet them on their way in. I mean, a typical example was I had an incursion at a place called Tepoy. And I knew they were coming because we were told that they were going to come in there. And I had a Gurkha company under command of the first 6 Gurkhas, commanded by a Gurkha officer called Harka Singh Rai, who'd got 2 MCs, great warrior. And I had this platoon with Harki's company. And Harki arranged for a whole lot of wires with cans on it to go from the village, from the kampong, to his company headquarters. And as soon as the local people jiggled the wire, Harki radioed my platoon that was dug in there. And the Indonesians came running down, or they're coming quietly down the track. And I had a fellow called Corporal Dignan there with a section dug in, actually, in a wonderfully sighted by the platoon commander post with overhead cover and everything else. And they opened fire on them. And there was a group of 4 went by them, and they killed 3 of the 4. And the Indonesians were very, very brave, and they always try and take the casualties away. And they spent the entire night trying to get this dead man out. And, of course, each time they did, my chaps would shoot them. But I said that, you know, we'd meet them where they come across, but I also put an ambush behind them so that when they were going out, that they would run into my ambush. The only thing was, unfortunately, they very sensibly went out by a different route and I missed them. But I had a gun dug in Tebedu, and I shelled them with the gun, and I'm told we killed quite a number. And that's why they left the track that they were going back down, the one I was going to ambush them on, and went down a different way. But it was very busy there.